Welcome to Exec Insights, conversations about Australian business and the changing world. I'm your host, Kate Joiner, from QUT's Graduate School of Business. Today we're talking about the business of creating Australian cities that we all want to live in. Not just live, but thrive. Australia is an urbanised country, with most of us living in the coastal capital cities. What does the future hold for our cities, and what will it take to build inclusive, resilient, productive and sustainable cities for all? Today I'm talking to Brooke Dixon. Brooke is Managing Director of Delos Delta, driving smart city and digital transformation for clients around the world. He's also Vice President of the Australian Smart Communities Association, and Brooke is also a Churchill Fellow, something that I'll explore in this interview a little later. So hi Brooke, how are you?
Good, Kate, thanks for having me. Good. Pleasure to be here.
Good, yeah, we've just had a really great session about smart cities and designing for smart cities. So Brooke's just come straight from that, so we really appreciate that. You're just fresh from all those exciting issues. So just to kick us off, so tell us more about Delos Delta and the work that you do.
Thanks, Kate. Yeah, no, look, Delos Delta is a young company, a growing and thriving company, I'm happy to say. What we do is we work with our clients locally, nationally and internationally to understand the possibilities and opportunities to apply digital technology to their business, their city, a government, a community, a region or a precinct, and allow them to apply it in such a way that it makes them more productive, sustainable and livable. And we're doing really cool things, like, for instance, working with colleagues in Barcelona who have this fantastic prioritisation methodology, which is inclusive, it brings the community along, and we're very much hoping to bring that to Australia very soon.
Prioritisation, so that's in terms of being able to vote on issues that they want government to deal with. Have I got that right?
Or am I more about when government or a community has a range of projects that they're considering, and but they don't know how to prioritise them. So in this particular scenario, you can choose what criteria you'd like to rank them against. You bring in your stakeholders into the meeting room and you go through a methodical process of doing so. And in Barcelona, they're finding remarkable benefits in not only actually delivering projects and products that have remarkable community benefit, but also people are happy because they're part of the process.
That's pretty cool stuff. And so the technology enables that process to be quite easy for people to participate in?
Exactly. Mm. It's really powerful in terms of its computational ability, but also powerful in terms of its ability to allow participation and deliberation and provide a democratic outcome. Too often in government these days, or in organisations for that matter, decisions are made in back rooms with cost-benefit analysis, with all sorts of assumptions made by expert economists, so to speak, which really makes it hard for people to come along for the journey. So part of the smart city approach is bringing people along and providing complexity behind the veil of simplicity.
Mm. Yeah, which is the potential for technology. So always, I came from local government, that we talked about the three P's, I suppose. So as the decisions are made as a sort of a creative tension between the politicians, the planners or the technocrats and the people. So, but often it was mostly about the first two and probably a lot about the politicians. So it has the potential, again, to bring in that third P, which is the people, more into that triangle of decision making.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. And I think the P that sort of umbrellas it all is power. And certainly the way our democratic institutions have evolved, certain power structures have come into place, and that allows more power to be with politicians and the party, less so with the people. But let's remember, the democracy from the ancient Greek is about the deem, the people, and kratos, the power to the people. And I'm a very big, strong advocate for that and believe that digital can support that evolution.
Yeah, it also goes to, in our public sector management program here, we're very fond of the strategic triangle of Cagram and Moore. So that talks about public value as the centre of government, what we're here to do. But often we don't know what the people think of as value. We're making a lot of assumptions about. So in local government, for example, we just always use a simple example: how many grass cuts do you need in your local park? And we deem that is, you know, a grass cut every month. Where people might think public value would be fine with two or three a year, and we could spend the money somewhere else. So the potential for bringing people into the process could mean we could have more public value, or because we could direct resources where they actually need to be directed. And also, I think there's not any money left in government to do things. So we don't solve things by throwing money at something. We have to make trade-offs. So it helps people bring into the process of making those trade-offs.
That's right, Kate. And certainly the other P you could throw around, because I do love alliteration, is, again, and I've said it before, prioritisation. So once you understand the people, and I do believe that in a smart city, we use technology to have deeper and more meaningful and broader conversations with our community. No longer should we just be satisfied with town hall meetings where 10 people turn up, or 300-page discussion papers where only four people who are very, very interested read it and put a submission in. We need to use these new technical methods to speak across our community, but also to engage with that 80 to 90% who are all often very supportive of progressive policies and programs, but are not engaged in the process. So look, there's remarkable opportunities there, Kate, and I do believe that we've got a lot to learn from our friends in Europe and Asia in this front. Australia's been traditionally quite conservative, but there are cool things happening around Australia, I have to say.
So tell us some of those cool things that are happening in Europe and US that we might be able to learn from.
Yeah, good question, Kate. And it is very exciting. And I was very lucky to travel around the world on a Churchill Fellowship last year to see smart cities in Europe, in Asia, and North and South America. I'm going to give you a little example from a less developed country, Lima in Peru, South America. They don't have as much money as we do in Australia and in Europe and Northern America. However, they understand that digital technology is the future, and they're doing cool things like taking out old shipping containers, taking them to the schools so the kids can engage with technology. That's really cool, that's really powerful, but it's also a really simple way of accelerating smart city capacity and maturity. I'll also give you another example from North America. North America are fantastic at taking smart technology and then building smart business models and smart financing models around them. I'll give you an example from San Jose, where Philips, the company, came to the council, upgraded 800 streetlights for the council at no cost. No cost to the council, therefore no cost to the citizens. Why was that free? Because 50 of those streetlights had microcell capability on them. That Philips could then sell that data capacity to the big telcos. So Philips is happy, they make some money. The city's happy, they get new assets. In fact, LED lights that save them millions of dollars annually in energy cost. And the citizens are happy because they get better lighting outcomes in terms of amenity and safety. They also get less black spots. That's really cool. That's smart city in action, but it's also smart business models, and I think it's fantastic. And Australia's
smart
got a lot to learn.
Smart business models, yeah, that's right. So that's a great example. So we all win. I suppose it's the same here in Brisbane, and in a lot of cities where we have the ad shell advertising, which pays for the actual bus shelter. So really smart business models. We need to create to think smarter too, so that everyone can win.
That's right, yeah. And look, I think too often we fall into two traps with the smart city and digital city dialogue. First of all, we make it all about technology. And technology is a really important ingredient, of course, but we've got to think about investment, smart people, smart processes, smart regulation, smart governance. So we've got to broaden out the discussion and not just think that we can throw technology in a city and that makes it intelligent. That's simply not the case. I think the second mistake that we made is that we don't have that engagement with the people as well. And we often think that to invest or to leverage the value of these new propositions, we just have to throw more money at it. And it is not the case. We can think more broadly. Our good friends in North America are doing just that, and we could learn from them, and that's fantastic.
Yeah, because there won't be the money to throw at it.
There simply isn't, Kate.
There isn't the money, yeah. And you're giving great examples about, the power, the digital can enable people to come together to force change to regulation. And, of course, Uber is a great example of that. So that when you were talking about the power, so it has the potential to bring the power to change regulation that isn't working for the people and lessens the power of the lobby groups and the interest groups, which really at the moment I think are a threat to the good functioning of our Westminster system, when we start getting tied up too much with interest groups.
Kate, I'm going to say two things about that. The first is that regulation that is out of date, that's archaic, that's anachronistic, is one of the greatest barriers to smart and sensible transformation of our cities. Now, that behoves both government and the community to be more proactive about how we're reviewing our regulations and modernising it, and not getting ourselves into situations like we did in most cities across Australia, where we're enforcing old transport regulations simply because a new business model emerged, i.e. Uber and Lyft and so forth, that the current existing transport regulations, which in many cases were 50 to 60 years old or based on laws that were that old, simply weren't functioning anymore. In Canberra, I have to say, and I'm very proud to have been part of those reforms, we were proactive on that front. We were the first capital city in the world, to regulate for ride sharing. That's for ride sharing before a company like Uber actually entered the market. And the rest of Australia followed that example. So it's really powerful. And can I say that the reason that worked was because the Chief Minister in the ACT engaged with the community and understood that the community were supportive of this change. Yes, unfortunately, some taxi plate holders were going to bear some costs. However, I should say in the ACT, regulation on taxis is coming down, which is part of providing that level playing field in the rideshare and taxi market, which is a good principle to abide by. And what we have to remember too is that when we think of this digital disruption, we often get caught up in demonizing Uber and Airbnb and these companies as multinationals who are there for a buck and don't care about anything and are happy to walk all over regulation. Remember, we should all remember that it's people that are driving it. We're the ones that want to use the platforms. We're the ones that want convenience. We're the ones that want to order food and cars and new accommodation on our phones. It's about people, and regulation has to catch up with what the people want. And politicians and politics and parliament, they all have to be on board with that, because power to the people.
Power to the people. So yeah, we've really got the power with our numbers, you know, to change some of the things that are constraining our ability to thrive in our cities. Yeah. So what's some regulation that you really think is ripe to move that's constraining the good and prosperous cities?
Absolutely. Look, I believe planning regulation. Planning regulation, it is ubiquitous. It is one of the pillars of our modern city. In fact, cities for as long as we can remember have always had some sort of regulation governing them in some way, shape or form. And in the modern world, we really haven't got to a point where we've integrated the way we regulate and govern the planning and development of our cities with digital technology. And I'm not just talking about the integration of new digital tools such as 3D modelling with planning guidelines, which is fantastic, and it's allowing us, using those models, to speed up the interface between developers and the city and the community, but also bring in the community, because the community understands a 3D rendering of a city, and very few of us, unfortunately, understand schematics and engineering diagrams. So there's a remarkable opportunity there to modernise our planning regulations and deliver not only efficiency and productivity for government and for our cities, but also to engage the community in a process of co-creation. I'll give you a little example of something that was changed recently in the Australian Capital Territory, and that was regulation which enshrined notifications out to the community that must be in newspapers. Now, this is something that obviously went back to when we were all reading newspapers and was a very effective means of communication, but not so much anymore. And the ACT government very carefully and very sensibly, in my opinion, moved to act on that and to modernise those regulations so we could actually use new digital channels and not spend hundreds of thousands of dollars unnecessarily each year in old communication mechanisms, and thereby, but also, communicating with the people where they wanted to be communicated with, no longer in newspapers, which most people, unfortunately, weren't picking up.
No, and yes, and in fact, we probably won't have newspapers at all to read those kind of notifications, unfortunately, which would be quite sad. Well, that's all fabulous, but you choose to live in Canberra. Just one of the nice examples you gave of just being able to get rid of parking meters, that was probably one of your smaller examples, but really quite interesting. So we were having a conversation before the podcast about living in a frictionless city. So taking parking meters away from us, I think, was a big leap forward. Would you agree?
Oh, completely. Look, Kate, I said 2 years ago when I was a public servant in Canberra, when they let me on the radio, that I wasn't in the habit of speculating, but I would like to predict that in 2 years' time, the old coin fen meters, I'm sure you've all dealt with them, the ones that tick, 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 and then they go green and then they go red, are very heavy, metallic, wonderful creatures, but they were destined for museums within 2 years. And I'm happy to say that the ACT government beat me, in fact, by 2 months, and had it under the 2 years, they removed the very last old coin-fed parking meters, and indeed the only place you can find them now is in the scrap heaps or in hipsters' living rooms or indeed in museums. But of course, in Canberra we still have the parking machines on the street where you can pay with credit card and so forth, which is fantastic. But what we're going to see more and more is the removal of those machines on our streets and the movement to phone-based transactions. Every time I park in Canberra now, I get straight out of my car, I'm walking to the coffee shop or my meeting, and I'm paying on my phone. Mm-hmm. If, for whatever reason, my parking expires, then I can just update it on the fly and top it up on my phone. Beyond that, which is fantastic, because I tell you what, I hate walking to parking meters and back to the car to get money, and then back to the parking
friction.
Meter,
that's
and
friction.
Then back to the car to put the, and then back to the car to put the paper ticket on it, and then having to run back from copy to update the car. That's crazy. I do it on my phone now, and what's going to happen, Kate, which as we've talked about before, is we're going to move more towards the inboard computers in the cars or the e-tag system where we pay our tolls. They will detect when we're parked. There'll be an account-based system that's automatically debited, which will be much more efficient, much more convenient, and really reduce the friction in the city. And that's
amazing.
I know, and
makes us all happier people, I reckon. We have to find all those kind of examples, I think.
No more parking rage, Kate. Wouldn't it be amazing?
Yeah, no more parking rage. Exactly right. We probably need to let you on your way, so I'll just ask our final That's Interesting question. So this is where we ask each guest something that they've read or they've seen that strikes them as something, I guess the world's changing or that's interesting. I'm coming up blank with it with an example, but I'll throw it to my guest. Brooke, what's interesting?
Well, look, I'm a student of history, and I studied ancient history, in fact, and in fact, that's where my company name comes from. The Delos, or the Delos in ancient Greek, is about showing the way and making
showing
clear.
Showing the way. So Telos is the purpose.
Showing the way, making Delos it clear, then. Making manifest, explaining. And the delta, of course, is the change. And that's what we're all about. So I draw on my historical training and my historical interests very much in my business life. But I've been reading a lot about the American Revolution and the democratic foundations of America. And I was very interested to find out, and I'm sure most students of American history know this, and all good Americans would, that the second and third presidents of the United States of America, being John Adams, President John Adams, and then being President Thomas Jefferson, in fact, died on the same day, 50 years after the Declaration of Independence. 50 years after the Declaration of Independence, on the exact same day, and that day was the anniversary of the Declaration of Independence of July 4th. So that is fantastic. And in fact, the last words of John Adams, who had come to terms with Thomas and Jefferson, they were very good friends early in their career. They became quite at enmity through their careers because they would offer at opposite ends of the political spectrum. They had come to terms in their later life and become very good friends again, which was fantastic. They had a wonderful correspondence. And the last words of John Adams was, Jefferson lives. Jefferson lives, and in fact, unfortunately, Thomas Jefferson had died some hours before John Adams on the same day. But of course, the greatest symbolism was that the essence of Thomas Jefferson and what he stands for, particularly through that Declaration of Independence, lives on and it does today. And that's an amazing story, and I'm really pleased to share it with you.
Brooke Dixon, thank you very much, and power to the people.
Power to the people.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Exec Insights. For more information about QUT's executive education programs, please search QUT Executive Education and you'll find a full range of our programs and services.